Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Fifty years ago this summer, seven words were made famous by comedian George Carlin. We can't say those seven words, which have become immortalized as the seven words you can't say on television. You can't say them on the radio either, and we won't. But we can say the 24 words that Carlin used to describe those seven words.
It seems to indicate that somebody was awfully interested in these words. They kept referring to them. They called them bad words, dirty, filthy, foul, vile, vulgar, coarse, in poor taste, unseemly, street talk, gutter talk, locker room language, barracks talk, bawdy, naughty, saucy, raunchy, rude, crude, lewd, lascivious, indecent, profane, obscene, blue, off color, risque, suggestive, cursing, cussing, swearing, and all I could think of was
Carlin's point was that for all the words we consider dirty, we have many, by his count, three times as many words we can say to describe the words we can't, or shouldn't, or who's making the rules anyway. In this case of TV and radio, it's the FCC, thank in part to Carlin's act. After a radio station played seven dirty words bit in the mid-70s with a warning about foul language, the Supreme Court ruled that the routine was, quote, indecent but not obscene, and that the FCC had the power to keep the airwaves free of language that was merely indecent. So now if there's a curse on our air right now, and then if one of you out there rats us out or is genuinely offended and contacts the FCC could send us a warning, urging us to correct our behavior or fine us or, in the most extreme case, revoke our license to broadcast. It's the government's version of cleaning your mouth out with soap, or, and that's why we also have a dump button, which Juliana, my editor, my engineer, has her finger ready to go for this entire segment. So that's one way to correct language that offends or prevent it. Another is the court of public opinion, as we saw recently in the news, when Australian disability advocate Hannah Devinney heard an ableist slur related to her own disability in Lizzo's new track, Girls. She composed a viral tweet raising the issue. Ultimately, Lizzo, the artist, went back into the studio and changed the track to remove the word, but not the curse. The word is a crude and cruel noun derived from the word spasm. The old lyric was, "Do you see this bleep? I'm the bleep." The new lyric is, "Do you see this bleep? Hold me back." Let's listen. Just a few weeks later, the same word appeared on Beyoncé's new track with Drake, Heated. In the opinion piece for The Guardian, Devinney wrote, "I'm so tired. Disabled people deserve better. I don't want to have this conversation again." That same day the piece ran in The Guardian, Queen Bey announced that she too would remove the word from the track. We're talking about words that offend. We want to get you in on this conversation. Are you offended by cursing? Is there a time when it is appropriate? We heard a bit during the January 6th hearings, for example. Maybe you want to share a memory about being corrected for certain uses of language. Our phone lines are open, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or maybe your family had a saying or a punishment that stuck with you to keep you from cursing, or maybe you had a parent, your parent having these conversations with your kids, or maybe there's a word that you used to say or a saying but were convinced that it was harmful and you changed your ways. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can tweet us or DM us on Instagram at all of it, WNYC. And please remember, we cannot say any of those words that you think on the air. And before your call, please come with an artful euphemism, if you would. Joining us for this conversation from the field of linguistics, please welcome Dr. Deborah Tannen, University Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University and author of many books about language and interpersonal relationships. Most recently, That's Not What I Meant, How Conversational Style Makes or Breaks Relationships. I'm so happy to have you on the show, Deborah.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Benjamin K. Bergen, director of the Language and Cognition Lab at the University of California, San Diego, whose book is called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Benjamin, thank you as well for joining us.
Hi, Allison.
So there's a term in linguistics for what George Carlin observed is metadiscourse, talking about talking. So Deborah, what is the reason that people like to talk about curse words as opposed to liking to use them?
People like to talk about anything that has emotional value associated with it. And as you could tell from George Carlin's introduction, people have very emotional reactions to curse words as well as words that they see as associated with a group that they may associate themselves with and feel the words are inappropriate. You know, we think language is just something transparent. You get through it and you see what people really meant. But the truth is, what people mean is shaped by the language they use and the words they choose. And people sense that. So I think that explains it.
Benjamin, you run the Language and Cognition Lab at your institution. What does one do in a language lab? I'm very curious. People think about labs and beakers and all. My mom was a science teacher. What does one do in a language lab? What do you
say? Well, one thing one might do is to answer questions like the ones that you just posed. So we ask questions about what people say, how they say it, how they understand language, how they learn language, what drives their attitudes about language. And we won't use as many beakers as maybe in the chemistry department. Instead, we're measuring things like reaction times, eye movements, sometimes things that are happening in brains, that sort of thing.
And how can that be useful in the outer world, outside of the lab?
Yeah. Well, language is obviously something that pervades our lives. It's the main way that we learn, at least early on in life. Mm-hmm. It's the main way that we preserve over the course of history information and knowledge, that we propagate that to future generations. And it's a way that we create ourselves in a social world. When we're using language, we are creating an image of ourselves by the words that we use. And so understanding how and why humans are able to do that tells us about what we are as both biological and also as social creatures.
Deborah, your work looks specifically at the social dynamics of language and how the ways we talk to each other shape our relationships. What's important to consider? This might sound like an obvious question, but what's important to consider when choosing our words and deciding which words we should or shouldn't say?
I think most of the power comes when we really aren't thinking and deciding, but simply using words in ways we think are automatic. Mm. And so much of my work is about how people think that they're reacting to what else somebody means, but they're really reacting to their use of language. Very simple ideas: turn taking. How do you decide when the other person's done and it's your turn to begin? And in the first study that I did, it became very clear that some people felt it's really appropriate to be completely silent until the other one begins to speak. And there are others who feel you don't want silence. That would be awkward in a conversation. So as soon as you sense someone winding down, you begin to speak. And so you end up with one person feeling interrupted and the other person not having intended to interrupt. In fact, there are styles where you talk along to show enthusiastic engagement. And if the other person stops, they're creating an interruption that you didn't intend. But there are so many other ways. Just another quick example. We all know that sometimes the words we use are not meant literally. So you've had guests for dinner and time to clean up, and the guest offers to help, and you say, no, 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 please stay seated. Do you really mean that? Or do you mean, I would love your help, but I don't want to ask for it? And so you really expect people to help anyway. I'm one of those who takes it literally. I had a friend who took it as a given that it's always the guest's job to help, whether the person says they don't want it or not. And we had to talk that out because I was thinking she was rude by continuing to work, try to help when I told her not to. And she thought I was rude by taking her word for it when she said she didn't want help. So those are just two examples of the way people's use of language makes an impression about the kind of person you are. And we make those decisions when we talk to people, not just what they mean, but what kind of person they are and what they think about us. And so when you have different, the word I use for that is conversational style, different ways of using language, you can draw conclusions that are not accurate about somebody's abilities, intentions, and people may be drawing inaccurate conclusions about you. So it's important to be aware of these different ways that people of different backgrounds can use language.
Our phone lines are full. We're screening carefully, although I have faith in our audience. I really do. Benjamin, how would you define what constitutes a slur? And what happens to our brains when we are the target or we perceive ourselves as the target of a slur?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, it's certainly the case that there are some words used to describe individuals as members of groups that come over time to be judged as negative, as having a negative connotation, as implying something derogatory about that individual by dint of their affiliation with that group. So maybe it's that group of people is not smart, or that group of people is not valuable in some way, or whatever negative attributes it is. That term is going to be interpreted by the people who feel that it has that power as a slur. That very same term, that very same word used at a different time or a different place or by a different person for a different reason, or just heard by a person who has a different belief about the word, will not be judged to be a slur if they feel that it's a word being used in a positive way, in a constructive way, in a way that doesn't have any of those negative connotations. So the main challenge with slurs is that their interpretation is entirely contextual and subjective to the person doing the speaking and the person doing the listening. What happens in people's brains when they're exposed to them? Well, we know that for strong profanity in general, including slurs when interpreted as such, there's a whole suite of physiological reactions that happen. It's kind of like what you see with a fight or flight response. You get a boost of adrenaline. You see dilation of the pupils, increased heart rate, blood pressure. You start sweating measurably from the skin. And that physiological reaction is triggered by words which we usually since childhood have been taught are strong and powerful and negative words.
Deborah, before I go to the phone, did you want to weigh in on what a slur is and how we react when we either are the target of them or in their presence? Deborah, did you have a thought about that, or did you want?
You know, I'm thinking of an experience that I personally had. I was talking to a colleague, and she used the expression "Jew somebody down," and suddenly she realized she's speaking to someone who is Jewish. She was extremely embarrassed, mortified, and to make it worse, she's German.
Oh no!
She was extremely eager to convince me that. She didn't learn that expression in Germany. She learned it in this country. And I think that's kind of interesting. There are the words that are offensive, but you're really not thinking of them as their literal meaning when you're saying them. She just learned it as a way to talk about trying to bargain a price down. But of course, it's associated with negative associations with Jews. And then the others are, as Ben was talking about, words that refer to a group. And those are interesting because they change with the times. Pretty much any group that is associated with negative connotations in the culture, the words for them seem to have a lifespan of about 10 or 20 years, and then they have to change because they have taken on the negative associations. For example, we now use Asian. At one time it was Orientals. I remember the very first time I was looking at a conference, it was about, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, maybe 20, and I saw there was a session in this linguistics conference that had the word queer in the title, and I was horrified. And I happened to be talking to a friend who was gay, and he was the one who alerted me that that word queer has been repurposed and reframed. Mm-hmm. As a positive thing, and now we have a field that we call queer linguistics, and a journal, I think, by the name too. So it's evolving, and you can't say anything about a word in terms of its dictionary meaning. It's always the associations with that word, how we see it used.
My guests are Dr. Deborah Tannen, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, and Benjamin K. Bergen, director of the Language and Cognition Lab at UCAL San Diego. We are discussing slurs and words and curses and the like. So we're going to go to the phones. We're going to keep our fingers crossed. Like I said, I do actually have faith in our listeners. Nick is calling in from Roslyn Heights on line two. Hi, Nick. Thank you so much for joining this conversation.
Oh, hi. Thank you for hearing me out. I am a retired teacher, middle school teacher, and I would quickly admonish my students when they use words, you know, they're really bad words, but even like the word sucks, S-U-C-K-S. Now, that when did that become a regular word? That should still be a profane word. And I am a human being. In times of anger and frustration, I have resorted to profane language. It should be like the Force. You know, you use it wisely. You only use it when you really, really want to mean it. Now, my philosophical question is, is our language ever going to be so debased? Because I would tell my students, guys, we are in a school. We are not hanging out in front of a liquor store drinking alcohol out of paper bags. Come on, guys, we're in school. You can't be using that language. Will we ever reach a day when there is no more profane language? It's just a philosophical question. Like,
I want to dive in because I saw Dr. Tannen say no. Okay, I'm going to let you weigh in, and as well as Benjamin. Will there ever be a time when there's no such thing as profane language? What an interesting question.
I believe there will never be such a time because it serves a purpose in social relations. And we should also be acknowledging there are situations where use of not necessarily the slurs, but what we're calling swearing is required to be one of the members of the group. A number of years, and it's a particularly challenging thing for women because in almost all cultures that I'm aware of, swear words are more acceptable for men and less so for women. So a number of years ago, I was interviewing a pilot, his work I was doing on the workplace, and he mentioned that before there were women in the cockpit, cursing was extremely common and, in fact, expected even. And he said, "It's when women are in the cockpit, we don't do that. And if they do, we don't like it." So that's a problem for women. They can't be one of the guys by using those words, and they can't be one of the guys if they don't use those words. So it's associated with situations. One other quick expression, example. My sister recalls when she was a kid and first learned the F word, she and her friends were, you know, talking about it, and somehow she became aware that my father knew that word, and she was scandalized.
The dadness.
Because my father is very proper.
Aww.
And my father at the time was a cutter in the garment district. And he laughed and he said, "Do you think I could spend an hour in the factory if I didn't know that word?" So it's very context dependent and very dependent on the meaning that has within the group. But to answer the caller's question, there will always be those social dynamics that require that kind of language.
We're going to take a quick break. After the break, we'll learn about the phonetics of swearing. Benjamin, I'm going to ask you about that. We'll take more of your calls. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour, Dr. Deborah Tannen, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, and Benjamin K. Bergen, director of Language and Cognition Lab at UCAL San Diego. You listeners are my guests as well. We are discussing the linguistics of slurs and swears. So, Benjamin, would you mind talking a little bit about the phonetics of swearing? Something called fricatives? I'm almost scared to say that.
Yeah, you're allowed to say fricative on the radio, I think. It turns out that languages like words that have similar meanings to sound similar, and English is not an exception to this. So if you think about the swear words that we have in English, there is a preponderance of them that have this sort of stereotypical sound structure. They tend to be about one syllable. There are some longer ones for sure, but they tend to be about one syllable, and they really like to have lots of consonants. Consonants at the beginning and consonants at the end. And the particular type of consonant that they like is something called a stop consonant or a plosive. That's the p, t, k. And I'm sure you can think of lots of your favorite swear words that start or particularly end with p, t, and k. And this has been studied across languages. It turns out that it's mostly English that has this pattern, this one syllable with lots of punchy consonants pattern. But across languages, it turns out that in the sort of most offensive words that languages have, there's a particular sound that they don't like, which is called an approximant, and that is also fine on according to the FCC. You can say approximant. An approximant is like l or wa or r, and it turns out that swear words tend not to have those sounds across the world's languages.
We've got a related call. This is Nettie calling in from Brooklyn on line 5. Hi, Nettie. Thanks for calling all of it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. It's a very curious phenomena, the way we say something or what we say. And I really like what he just said about previously about the triggering of a word, where something, maybe you grew up with that word or you felt different about the way the word was being used. And it seems to be, yes, ever-changing perceptions of a word or where you're coming from. I mean, personally, and also how you're affected, you know, in, in your representation of self, and, you know, whether you're allowed to not follow in the footsteps of whoever is raising you or whatever you're listening to, and always be aware of questioning, how that word is being used. So as we go further, I don't think that a lot of words change that quickly. And the meanings, I mean, just when, you know, this whole, the spaz word came about, you know, it's like the spasm or, you know, spasmodic or, this was actually, it's a very interesting thing how they're not being used in songs or whatever, correcting it and being, evoking something else that we weren't used to, something we just took for granted. It was just something, it was like, you know, bullying or something along those lines, or I don't know, if you're being spastic, you know, it's something like a kid would say it, but then, of course, now you grow older and now you're getting a reconsideration of understanding what a word is. So, okay, so here we are. And you know, I just had mentioned, we were talking little, there's a few things, and I just want to be very precise here. A word that triggers me more than, I won't go into the Yiddish words because that's a whole different realm. And it also is the consideration. I mean, even if you use, I'll go back to what the word I really, you know, bothers me so much in so many ways, is the N word.
Yes, I knew we'd get there. Thank you for Nettie. Yeah, Nettie, I'm going to dive in here because I want to make sure we get to other people. We'll get to that in just a moment. Let's go to Rob. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Robin calling from Delaware on line 6, who's been holding. Robin, you're in healthcare and you wanted share your experience.
I hope you can hear me. The quality of the phone is going in and out, so hopefully you hear everything I need to say. But I thank you very much for letting me speak. I'm in healthcare, and I'm always trying to help people stay a little bit more in the cognitive and manage their emotions as well as we can. What I find is that not so much in my professional setting, but in my private setting, I often run into people that don't have great coping skills, and their mouth just goes off with expletives. And the only thing I can tell myself is that they just don't have a great vocabulary. They can be very smart, don't get me wrong, but it's upsetting to me to think that they may choose to just go off like that and use all these awful words repetitively. And I think that when I, as an outsider, listen, they've lost me. And I was just curious if anyone else has thought about using expletives as a coping mechanism, and maybe really don't connect with people you think you're trying to connect with. It's really just about you being upset.
That's really interesting. Deborah, I'm gonna let you take that one if you've got any thoughts about the idea that people often use curses, or Benjamin, you can take this, as a coping mechanism, not really understanding the impact.
I have not experienced or observed that in particular, but what I thought of listening to the caller's account, it's an interesting phenomenon that one of the symptoms or associated with Tourette's disease is cursing involuntarily. And it's interesting because Tourette's is about tics, various tics that are repetitive and that the individual doesn't have any control over. Why would coprolalia, we call it, why would the curse words come out? And it must be something about it's not being, you sometimes think about the words you're not supposed to say. That's my only guess why it might be. And you think of it, and so it comes out.
It's why, so interesting you say that. I want to ask Benjamin, this is something I thought about. So when in our studio, we have the list of the seven words. And it's right there next to the microphone. And every once in a while, I'll show it to a guest. And I remember having a guest say, oh, don't show it to me. I'm going to say them because you've shown them to me. What is there something about that idea of we're not supposed to say them that could trigger someone to say them?
Well, people try to do that when you asked earlier, what do you do in a language and cognition lab? You do that kind of thing. So you actually bring people in and you try to trick them into swearing by priming them with these words, for example, and putting them under different sorts of stress, time stress or social stress, and try to see what the triggers are to figure out what are the brain mechanisms that drive that sort of thing. So yes, absolutely. When people have a word in mind, but they're presented with it, or it's just sort of come in endogenously, they are much more likely to say that word, especially if there's some stressor on them.
Let's talk, for example,
on the radio.
Let's talk to Mike from Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey, who has got a question. Hi, Mike. Thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a songwriting professor, and I usually teach that using curse words in songs to be emphatic or, you know, try and sound angry is kind of a cop-out and sort of a cheap way to make your point. And it's better to try and craft your lyrics to sound emphatic. And I'm just curious what your guests would say about that. Am I on the right track there, do you think? Is it a little bit of a cheap shot to use a curse word in a song or a poem? I understand with like rhyming or something like that, it might be the best choice. But just in general, that's sort of my take on that. I'm curious what you think.
Deborah, Benjamin, go ahead.
You sound like Seinfeld, right? That's there's a whole school of thought in not just in songwriting but also in comedy that working blue is cheating, right? That it's just too easy, and the reason that it's too easy is because it does drive reactions, not just the physiological reactions I was talking about earlier, but social reactions. So if someone uses a word that you know is proscribed in a particular context, they are violating norms. And that norm violation is something that triggers a reaction. Now that, as someone was saying earlier, that could be a negative judgment, right? You could drive someone to believe that you are out of control or that you don't know the social mores or that you don't have enough respect for them to exhibit the appropriate behavior in that context. Or the social judgment could be positive. In the right context, like Deborah was saying earlier, it could be that you're judged to be more social, more comfortable with them, more informal, more part of the group, funnier. It kind of depends on what the audience is expecting you to do, what they think the appropriate behavior in that situation is. So to be concrete, if the lyrics are going to be heard by people in sort of mixed context with kids and maybe somewhat formal, they're probably going to be a lot of negative judgments about the use of that language. But if they're meant to be consumed in, you know, groups of highly energetic and, you know, caffeinated or maybe consuming other sorts of substances, young people who are already all full of adrenaline, then maybe that's exactly the type of thing that they would expect and would feed into an experience of listening to the music that would be appropriate. So the answer is it depends on context.
Let's talk to Barbara. Hi, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. So I want to say that I understand the theory behind someone who curses a lot, perhaps not having a high education or a wide vocabulary. But I would say to you that I have advanced degrees, and I'm 70 years old. And I would say to you that in the last 6-7 years, I find certain curse words enormously satisfying. And I can't quite think of any other words to use to replace a few key curses.
Thank you for sharing that, Barbara. We really appreciate it. But Benjamin, you were sort of laughing, but laughing in a sense of, I have a feeling you have something else to say about this.
No, there were.
Which relates to your cognition lab.
I do. Yeah. Well, there have been a number of studies looking at correlates of swearing frequency. So, if a person reports that they swear a lot, what are other features of their personality, their background, education, and so on? It turns out that people who, now these are college students, so they're already at a certain level of education, but college students who report swearing more frequently are also better able to perform a bunch of other linguistic tasks. So they have better active vocabulary, for example. They can come up with more words, you know, give them a task like say as many words that start with K as you can in a minute. They do better on that. They also score higher on part of this personality test called the Big Five inventory. There's part of it that's called intellect, which isn't really intelligence. It's more like openness to new experiences. And people who report swearing more also score higher in intellect in the Big Five personality character. I see that the engineers are celebrating in the back there.
yes.
So, look, this, you know, the correlation is not causation. If you swear more, your brain isn't going to you're not going to turn into a nuclear physicist. But there's certainly no evidence of the reverse, that there's a lack of intelligence or openness or anything as evidenced by swearing more.
Deborah, I wanted to get your take on it. We have various different versions of this question. Very different versions of this question. Pardon me, my dog is cursing and dog and puppy. He's not very happy right now. That there are certain words that people grew up with. They feel comfortable saying. They don't feel like changing the word. I'm thinking about one. I've seen a couple versions. When you have been robbed of something. I remember when I was a child, when you were robbed of something, you felt somebody was cheating you. It's a word that is derogatory towards Roma people and various gypsies. I've heard people who are completely well-educated describe somebody getting put in a police car, which is associated with Irish people who drink. We'll just leave it there. What is your take on when it's something that is part of the language previously, and you have people who just think, you know what, I didn't mean it. I don't mean it as a bad thing. It's part of my lexicon. I'm not changing.
What's so striking about that is that people don't like change, and they don't like being accused of negative intentions if they felt they didn't have any. So I think there's a sense, if I change because you told me it's bad, that means I'm bad. And I'm not. I meant well, so I shouldn't change. But it is so much a part of the way language works and the way culture works, that people become aware of things that they were not aware of before. This very much started in the 60s, I think, where people were aware of connotations of words and associations with groups of people. And there's I think the impulse is for some, if you find out that this offends people, then cut it out. But I think sometimes people are just resistant because they know that was not their intention. And often the association isn't in the words, so they have a good argument to say it doesn't mean that. But of course, as I said before, meaning is use. It's not a dictionary definition.
Thank you to all our callers who called in and everyone who did not curse. We really appreciate you. Also want to say thank you to Dr. Deborah Tannen and Benjamin K. Bergen. Thank you so much for guiding our conversation today. We really appreciate your time.
It was fun.
Great talking to you. Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.